Hey everyone, this is Cameron from Renegade Animation on renegadepopculture.com. If you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, and a rating on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to us. We are everywhere. Also, make sure to share our episodes around. If you like what we do, please give us some support over on our Patreon app. That way we can keep doing what we love, and that's talking about the last three main Ghibli films before The Boy and the Heron. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to a very special episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
Because we are inching ever closer to the release of Hayao Miyazaki's The Boy and the Heron, and because, life has gotten in the way, we are racing to the finish line of our Ghibli journey. We only have three films left, and honestly, this is a very interesting selection. The last one that we spun was Ponyo, and the two that are left after that were Kiki's Delivery Service and The Tale of the Princess Kaguya. So we will begin with Ponyo.
Yeah, so this is the film that came out in 2009. This was right after Howl's Moving Castle was released, a little bit before the infamous Tales from Earthsea was getting released. For those that were maybe still in love with Howl's Moving Castle but found its story polarizing, Ponyo is a return to the more direct elements of why people love Miyazaki. And we follow the son of a sailor, 5-year-old Sasuke, lives a quiet life on the oceanside cliff with his mother, Lisa. One fateful day, he finds a beautiful goldfish trapped in a bottle on the beach, and upon rescuing her, names her Ponyo. But she is no ordinary goldfish. The daughter of a masterful wizard and a sea goddess. Ponyo uses her father's magic to transform herself into a young girl and quickly falls in love with Sosuke. But the use of such powerful sorcery causes a dangerous imbalance in the world. As the moon steadily draws nearer to the earth and Ponyo's father sends the ocean's mighty waves to find his daughter, the two children embark on an adventure of a lifetime to save the world and fulfill Ponyo's dream of becoming human. So let's get the comparisons out of the way. Yes, this is tangentially Miyazaki's take on the Little Mermaid formula. You got the red-headed adventurous heroine who wants to learn more about the human world, falling in love with a human boy, and an overly protective father figure just wants her to be safe and for there to be balance among the ocean and the humans. This is also one of those that came out like right around the same time as this is a one of those like Kiki's Delivery Service that's a childhood favorite. And for me personally, I do think it's a rather delightful movie because while it does have a lot of Miyazaki's themes like love, saving the environment, it doesn't feel as bogged down like Howl's Moving Castle did because I still love Howl's Moving Castle, but the war commentary got in the way of what was a coming of age love story. And here it's like reverse. And while the dad does make mention and reference of like the war with the humans, there's no real war per se.
It's more just like something that's just mentioned off to the side, but I like that this movie keeps the focus pretty squarely on Ponyo and Sosuke's relationship. Their camaraderie throughout the whole thing It's honestly just really sweet and delightful. In my Letterboxd review, I said if there was a try not to smile challenge while watching this movie, I would have failed in like the first 15 minutes, if not sooner.
It's a very charming movie, from the children to the adults to the elderly characters that we encounter along the way. And it's also just sweet. It's a very genuine kind of sweet, as Sosuke and Ponyo do act very much like children. Sosuke maybe a little more mature due to how his father, Koichi, voiced by Matt Damon, is constantly out to sea because he's a sailor. And there is like some scenes where the tension between his job and being there for his family is brought up with his wife, Lisa, voiced by Tina Fey. But it's more from the perspective of Sosuke and Ponyo, who are voiced by Frankie Jonas and Noah Cyrus. It's a lot of fun to see the world through their eyes, and the interactions that the characters have with the kids, because it's Sosuke's love and care for Ponyo is so straightforward. There's nothing complex about it, which is fine. This movie doesn't need to be a philosophical college essay on the battle between humans and nature. Because what's most important to Sosuke is that Ponyo's okay. And then Ponyo's, well, outside of wanting ham at all times, wants to be with Sosuke. And their love for one another is so sincere.
And also unconditional.
And I like that even though a bunch of really absurd things that do happen, they don't make that big of a deal about the more magical aspects. And they even come up with some very creative things, like Fujimoto, voiced by Liam Neeson, Ponyo's dad. How he walked on land is using what looks like a weed spray can. And Lisa even makes a comment saying that, like, that better not be weed killer. And he's just like, how dare you? This is the purest water from the ocean. Like, you should be thankful. I think some of my favorite moments are with the elderly characters, with Kaio, voiced by Cloris Leachman, Toki, voiced by Lily Tomlin, and Yoshi, voiced by the late, great Betty White. I love that moment where Yoshi is like, that better not be Sosuke, because I know a good boy is supposed to be in school right now. Like, I better not be losing my mind. And Sosuke is just like, no, it's me. And she's just like, oh, thank goodness, my mind is sane still.
I love the elderly trio. They're just a lot of fun. Also, when Fujimoto puts like the, it looks like a jellyfish dome over community center or whatever, they no longer need their wheelchairs. They can walk freely.
Yeah, it's so joyful to see scenes like that. Just like something that brings them back to memories of the past and when they were children. And you see the different relationship dynamics between like Lisa and Koichi, where Lisa is a very headstrong mom. I mean, it's a Ghibli movie. The moms should be pretty entertaining and great. I love how no nonsense she is, and how she's willing to drive a little recklessly just to get to the job and for Sosuke to get to school and for them to avoid the giant tidal waves. For some reason, a lot of people had a huge issue with Lisa because they found her reckless. And, y'all, it's like there's a difference between a parent character who is written to be unlikable and just one who's a little more energized by life. And like, I mean, if you want to complain about something, Koichi is barely in the movie and he has such a nothing personality outside of I love my son, but he's never there.
I I think the only reason why he's even in this movie is to flesh out the world, because one thing that this movie also leans in on is the community aspect of whatever town this is. Everyone you see is like working together to make sure, for example, the elderly are taken care of, or that everyone's evacuated after the giant tsunami. Community is very important to the people here. So at the same time, I'm also thinking, like, what actually is the relationship between Koichi and Lisa? Are they still technically together? Are they divorced? Or I know he's one of those like father figures who is always traveling for work, but for the purposes of the narrative, his role is very minimal.
And I think that's fine, but it is interesting how more people ragged on Lisa than the dad when they would probably find some flimsy excuse for the dad to for why he's out there at all times. And we even get like more insight about the relationship between Fujimoto and Grandma Mary, the goddess of the ocean, voiced by Cate Blanchett, where he is taking his job very seriously of making sure the ocean is okay, while Gran is more, let's see what happens, like, and whatever happens, happens. Because Fujimoto is constantly worried about Ponyo being in love with a human, and Gran is like, well, you know what? We'll put him through a test. If he truly loves her, then she will become human. And Fujimoto is worried because he understands the flaws of humanity and is like afraid of her turning into foam, which is how the original Little Mermaid ends. It's like Miyazaki's take on Little Mermaid is somewhere in between. It implies a darker side to the story, but it's more lightweight.
I've always considered this less like a adaptation and more a loose.
Interpretation.
Yeah.
That's how I have to look at it. And really, that's how you have to look at a lot of Studio Ghibli adaptations. They are interpretations of famous books, but they're not going to be one-on-one adaptations. So honestly, I think that's for the best. I think Miyazaki and the folks at Ghibli love the ideas of certain stories, but they still want to get a crack at it with their own takes of like story and writing and themes. And I totally forgot how different the visual look for this film is. It's very much like after the, like, I mean, Howl's Moving Castle looks amazing. I'm not trying to throw shade at it or anything, but after how like heavily detailed the world was of like Howl's Moving Castle, Ponyo is kind of like the Lilo and Stitch of Studio Ghibli, if that makes sense, because it's a smaller scale story, just takes place in this one seaside town, and it has a more watercolor look to everything. More, not that there's like no lighting or shading on the characters, but more flat colors towards everything. I mean, like when you see the Grandma Mary, she looks great. She's fully lit and beautiful. But you look at like Lisa or Sosuke, and it doesn't have the same intricate detail that previous Ghibli films have. And I think that's appealing on a lot of levels.
It's like Miyazaki went back to sort of the simplicity of something like My Neighbor Totoro, but in some ways still kind of taking inspiration from, say, like the designs from like Spirited Away. I see a little bit of some of those designs in Fujimoto, particularly in the nose and other facial features.
Right. Like, it still has a lot of that creative Ghibli charm. It's just more the coloring is different. It was interesting to see how the characters moved among the more watercolor backgrounds. And of course, the water looks amazing with the giant fish spirits. And Again, I do love how everyone just kind of like, well, it's flooding. All right. There's not much we can do outside of make sure everyone's okay.
They treat it like a fire drill almost.
It's just funny because they're all like, look at these old ancient fish that are all around here. When I would have been like, oh my God, look at that thing. That thing's gonna freaking bite my leg off if it catches me. No, everyone's just like, eh. They still don't skip on how great the food looks. Probably still one of the best bowls of ramen that you'll find. Overall, I still very much enjoy this one. Like, it's so charming. It was going to get lost in the shuffle a little bit because of the year it came out in the US, because 2009 was so stacked. Like, you had Coraline, Up, The Fantastic Mr. Fox, The Princess and the Frog, Secret of Kells. Very good year for animation.
Oh yeah, no, for
Can't really,
sure.
I like a lot of animation fans say it's one of the best years of animation, and I agree. Oh God, and Mary and Max, that's another good one we should talk about sometime. Anyway, in terms of like the English voice cast, I think they're pretty good. I'm still not a huge fan of Tina Fey's voice work. But I think it works well for Lisa's character. And Fujimoto, like with Liam Neeson's voice, brings like that wary gravitas that you need for a father who is just so exhausted by the world and of humans. And of course, Noah Cyrus and Frankie Jonas are cute as the kids. Betty White, Cloris Leachman, and Lily Tomlin are great as the elderly trio. I will say it's probably not my favorite music from Joe Hisaishi, but it's still a great overall soundtrack. I think what makes it a little less for me is the whole situation of the song that plays at the end. I mean, I get it. It's like the children singing the Ponyo theme. It just reminds me a little too much of the Totoro kind of vibe, but that's just me. And Joe Hisaishi is still one of the film world's great composers.
Absolutely. Pretty much everything you said about the voice cast, I agree with. I think Cate Blanchett, for however little dialogue she has, is just kind of perfect for Grandmamar.
She's great. I mean, these Ghibli films always have good voice casts. They're not going to have a bad one. Even Earwig and the Witch still has a generally good voice cast for the English dub. It's just everything else about that movie doesn't work. Same with Tales from
Yep.
Earthsea. Not my favorite batch of voice actors, but they still put in good performances, like from Cheech Marin and Willem Dafoe and Timothy Dalton. But otherwise, I don't have much else to say. It's not that, like, this movie's super simple. It's just more, I guess, more straightforward than like Miyazaki's other movies where there's more nuance to talk about. It's a young love story first over a story about environmentalism and the war between nature and humans.
And sometimes that's just exactly the kind of movie that you need. There's nothing wrong with simplicity, and I'm not quite sure where the stigma came from, but nevertheless, Ponyo is just delightful.
I think the stigma comes from the fact that when there's also push of like when you see films like Anomalisa or The Boy in the World or like Inuo or Belle, where they tackle like thematic commentary for what have you. And people want to see that, but it also means like that push and drive for it is going to overshadow a lot of just great movies that are great because they don't try to draw outside the line. Let's just say that. But anyway, Ponyo, very good. Should have probably been a runner up for the win for best animated feature, but you know, kind of hard when Up is just so good.
Exactly.
Because after this, definitely going to be diving into two other Ghibli films that have a more complex storyline to them, with probably the most popular Ghibli film if you were a child, because it was probably like the one you watched the most, or really was the one you watched first when getting into Studio Ghibli, because it was probably the most widely available one next to My Neighbor Totoro with Kiki's Delivery Service. A young witch on her mandatory year of independent life finds fitting into a new community difficult while she supports herself by running an air delivery service. This one is so special to a lot of people. I think you probably see more video essays and film content creators talk about this one movie, maybe next to Princess Mononoke the most.
The first time I ever heard of not just this movie, but like Hayao Miyazaki just in general. I don't know how much you remember the old Disney VHS promos from like the 90s.
I remembered those. Yeah.
Promo for the English dub of Kiki's Delivery Service was one of those constant previews that has stuck in my brain for the past 20 years. Which is one of the reasons why the fact that I'm only just seeing this movie now continues to surprise so many people.
It's also oddly one of those films that, for some reason or another, male filmgoers are more openly admitting to watching. Because for some reason, there's a stigma where it's like, oh, you're a guy, you can't watch movies with women or female lead characters. And it's like, why not?
Exactly.
There's a reason why Kiki's Delivery Service is so good, and it boils down to why people like movies. It's the character dynamics, it's the story, it's how universally relatable Kiki's journey is, because it's a coming-of-age story where she's, well, granted, normally people who try to go find their way in life wait until they're 18 so they can, actually drive, find their own ways in life. Like, who doesn't have thoughts about like not being stuck in like a little podunk town and moving into the big city, but just adventuring out there into the world to find what you want in life and where you fit in and what exactly is driving you to do what you do? And it's a very laid back approach to that kind of storytelling, because a lot of the conflict for Kiki doesn't really happen until the halfway point when, because like at first, she's just like, no worries, I'm going to leave and it's all going to be great and nothing's bad's going to happen. But then when she gets to this small seaside town, she realizes how tough it is, like having to be an adult and such. How are you going to sustain yourself? How are you going to make money and where are you going to live and what have you, which is all super relatable, like no matter what age and what have you. And then she finds herself taking a room in the back of this bakery, which is home of probably the two best secondary characters of Studio Ghibli films, because like there is so much love for Osono and
Fukuo?
Miz. He's just the
True.
silent baker who is really good and really passionate about his job. And you have the earliest pieces of media for people who like are starting out in animation and watching movies like this, where they see how Osono is proactive. Like, yeah, she's pregnant and she does know that she can't be walking around at all times, but she's a very good role model. She's like, yeah, I'm pregnant, so what? I still have to run a bakery. And like most of the time, like the lesser films would have just had her stationary at all times, but she's very active within Kiki's time in this seaside town. And she is just great. And Tress MacNeille does a great job bringing her to life with the English dub, which this is one of those cases where a Ghibli film has had two different English dubs. But I personally prefer this one, and not just because it has Tress MacNeille. I mean, it's a very interesting cast in general, with Kiki being voiced by Kirsten Dunst. Matthew Lawrence voices Tombo, the boy that Kiki falls in love with and is obsessed with aerodynamics because, you know, it's a Miyazaki movie.
Yep.
Someone's gotta love aviation. And then we also encounter like this painter who lives out in the woods, voiced by Janine Garofalo, named Ursula. Then these two elderly women, the Madame and Barca, voiced by Debbie Reynolds and Eddie McClurg. And I love the small roles of Kokiri and Okino, Kiki's parents, who are voiced by Jeff Bennett and Kath Sose. Kind of like a mini Dexter's Laboratory reunion there.
Yeah. Now that you think about it.
And of course, we have other voice actors that you can easily spot if you have a keen ear, with like Pamela Adlon playing Ket, the little boy. Ket's mother, played by Diane Mitchell, the senior witch who's like, I'm very good with fortune telling. Bye-bye. Voiced by Debbie Derryberry, who y'all would know as, like, you know, Jimmy Neutron and such.
Yep.
Laura Cody, Sherry Lynn, Matthew Kerman Miller, Gregory Snegoff. And there are some, like, additional voices done by, like, John Hostetter, Scott Minville, Faye DeWitt, John Demita, Eddie Fearson.
Corey Burton. You know,
plays the radio announcer. But the cast member that a lot of people hold near and dear to their hearts is Kiki's cat, Gigi, voiced by the late, great Phil Hartman. And I think this was his last role before he sadly passed away.
It was one of his last. This was one of, like, three posthumous roles that were released in 98.
He's great. I know some people have said that he apparently had more additional lines in the movie, but I was never too bothered by how much he talked in the movie. He was like the companion and conscience of Kiki, so I liked his presence. He's also probably the cat character of Ghibli's filmography that people think of the most. Like I said earlier, it's a very low-key movie because it's just Kiki starting out just with her delivery company and bonding with some of the folks that are in this town, from this mom and her kid, with probably also one of the best dog characters of any Ghibli filmography.
Jeff is a good boy.
Jeff is a very good boy. I love that whole sequence of Gigi having to pretend to be the cat toy for a few hours. And then Jeff is just like, I knew Gigi was a real cat and I won't tell the family. I mean, not that he says anything, but you can tell like how much character is put into his expression and movements.
It reminded me of those classic Looney Tunes shorts with, I think it was like Spike and the kitty.
Oh yeah, the one where the dog is trying to hide the cat from the owner the whole episode or short. That's a great one. I also wonder if that one also inspired some of the sequences from Monsters, Inc. when Sully thinks the kid is going to the trash mulcher.
It has to, because those shorts are probably some of Chuck Jones's best.
But right around the halfway point of Kiki's delivery service, something changes. It's like a change in the air of what this movie is really all about. Because Kiki, after feeling like she has failed the past few deliveries, and granted, some of the clients were going to be terrible no matter what, like the birthday girl being like, yeah, my grandma sent me another crappy casserole. And it's just like, man, like, girl, be quiet. I would have loved to have gotten a casserole made by my grandmother for my birthday or whatever.
Much disrespect.
But like, what happens is Kiki starts to lose her confidence in who she is, and having that moment in time where you're not quite sure who you are and what exactly you want to do, which is where the film takes a turn with a few changes. Gigi stops talking, and I think that's really the last time you hear Phil Hartman is during that first half of the movie. And it turns into more of like Kiki building up the bonds with the human characters like Tombo and realizing how they're both such teenagers. Like Tombo is wholly unaware of why Kiki was so grumpy about him having other female friends. Then Kiki and her relationship with Ursula, the artist. I really like those moments where Kiki is just talking with Ursula, where they're just talking about life and helping out with painting. And this is why movies like Kiki's Delivery Service work so well. You love these characters, and they feel so lived in within their world that the studio and the creatives put into it.
This is honestly for me when the movie goes from really good to amazing, and I absolutely see why this has become one of their beloved classics. Because anyone who's gone through any sort of like, whether it's like writer's block or burnout, you know, any sort of feelings of anxiety, depression, all of that, can relate to all of the struggles that Kiki's going through in the second half of the film.
A universal story, even though this is a world where witches and magic exist. But that's kind of the interesting thing about this movie. The magic is not a big part of the world and experience. People are just like, cool, a witch. No, like, oh my gosh, witches, evil, burn them or whatever. It's just like, huh, okay.
This is kind of a classic example of magical realism where there's really only one supernatural element, but everything else is an otherwise just mundane environment.
And I mean, like, granted, a lot of people might have said that, like, the weakest part of Kiki's Delivery Service is the final act, even though it is, like, I mean, I get it because this film is so laid back and taking its time, and then you're just kind of thrust into the Hindenburg situation of the giant blimp crashing and Kiki having to save Tombo. Like, after rewatching it, I don't think it's that noticeable of a sudden shift. I think it's more like apparent in some of Ghibli's other movies because you see build up to the moment where Kiki gets her magic back from the midpoint to now, like to this third act conflict. I think it flows better than some of the film's bigger detractors say it does.
I agree with that. And while on the surface it sounds a jarring shift in tone, in context it makes a lot of sense because part of what gets Kiki flying again is finding that spark, finding that inspiration. What better inspiration than helping out a close friend?
And another thing that changes about the world around Kiki's Delivery Service, like near the end, granted she gets her powers back and Osono has her children, but stuff like Gigi doesn't talk again. It's like she had Gigi as like a support system, and now that she has the inner strength to use her magic and fly and have better control of it, she doesn't really need a talking cat.
Plus, Gigi's happy with his new lady friend.
Oh, that's a cute little story arc of just like, oh, well, excuse me, lady. It's a sweet movie. So straightforward and lovingly crafted. I understand why this is one of those. Like the Mount Rushmore of Ghibli films, it's like My Neighbor Totoro, Spirited Away, and Kiki's Delivery Service, with maybe a fluctuation depending on what you find to be your personal favorite Ghibli film of the collection, because it could be like Castle in the Sky or Howl's Moving Castle or Ponyo. But it's really like My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service, Spirited Away, and yeah, maybe Princess Mononoke. Okay. Also.
That sounds like the most like accepted Mount Rushmore.
Oh, and Grave of the Fireflies, of course. Speaking of Grave of the Fireflies, we are now here to talk about the great and sadly not here with us anymore, Isao Takahata, and his last movie from 2013/2014, The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, which is based on a Japanese folklore tale of the same name. Found inside a shining stalk of bamboo by an old bamboo cutter and his wife, a tiny girl grows rapidly into an exquisite young lady. The mysterious young princess enthralls all who encounter her, but ultimately she must confront her fate. It sounds a lot more ominous than it actually is, because, well, so this came out around the same time as, like, was in the 2014 Best Animated Feature nominees, which were shared by this, Song of the Sea, and Big Hero 6, if I remember. Because I remember it was a very stacked year. It was also a very controversial year because this was the year when the Lego movie got snubbed because people were like, why? Then that one animation website we won't talk about was just like, well, you guys really love a toy commercial. And it's like, bro, shut up. But yeah, so it was nominated alongside Song of the Sea, How to Train Your Dragon 2, The Box Trolls, and Big Hero 6. And honestly, Song of the Sea or Tales of the Princess Kaguya should have won over Big Hero 6 because Princess Kaguya is a truly ambitious masterpiece from a very good filmmaker, like who is no longer around anymore.
This movie is, it just is a masterpiece. Probably one of the best final features that any director could have ended their career with.
It's another example of a movie where the differences between Isao Takahata and Miyazaki are very, very obvious, because as much as they make movies with similar tones and vibes, Isao Takahata is more willing to have a somber tone throughout his movie, even to have like an ending that is more sad than anything else. Like we talked about this with Pompoko, where it wasn't really a happy ending, it was like a compromised ending.
Bittersweet.
And same thing with this one, where it follows, like, in general, the original folk tale of these two village folk who find Kaguya within a bamboo shoot and watches as she grows bigger in a fairly short amount of time. They don't really exactly say how fast the growth is of Kaguya as like baby to like a young adult. And it doesn't help that the art style for this one paints everyone in a very similar way of like not having the traditional Ghibli look. It has this amazing and beautiful watercolor ink style that apparently made this one of the most expensive animated films in Japan at around like 46 or so million dollars, if I remember correctly.
49, but close enough.
You can see why this one costs so much, with really Takahata taking his experience with working on films like My Neighbors the Yamadas, which was our first trip into the Ghibli journey, to here, where Takahata wanted to be more experimental and push the envelope with animation. Where, you know, Miyazaki did what he did and it worked for him. Not to say that he couldn't have done or expanded into more experimental forms of animation. I mean, we literally saw a documentary that was all about him learning how to animate in CGI. But Takahata was the more forward of the two who wanted to do something different. That's why his films still have a very distinct vibe to them that Miyazaki, like, the best part is both of Miyazaki and Takahata had distinct directing styles with how they told their stories.
You can't really confuse one for the other, and this movie makes that abundantly clear.
This one has a story, but it's told much more like a storybook that you would read to someone instead of having a more structured experience like some of Takahata's other works. It takes its time with having us see and observe how free Kaguya feels at the beginning, because a lot of this movie is about finding happiness in life. And you see that she is happy when she is playing with her friends in this small village and just having no one tell her or define her existence. It's not until the bamboo cutter and the bamboo cutter's wife, who are voiced by Mary Steenburgen and the late James Caan, when they start getting gifts from the bamboo shoots, and they take it as a means of, oh, we must take control of what our daughter wants. So we think with this gold and these great fabrics, she must live with royalty. So they move like to the capital, and Kaguya starts to really see the flaws of the society that they live in, where women really have no control of who they are or who they can be with. I mean, it's a thematic story that we've seen through multiple pieces of art, like the Blue Eye Samurai, for example. That was literally one of the characters' driving goals, was to not just be sent away to be some lord's wife and whatever. You watch as she gets suitors, and just to see how her happiness stopped being about what she wanted and what her parents wanted. So she took the initiative to be like, okay, fine, I have these suitors here. Well, if they can get me what I want, then I'll marry them. And another big thematic point of this movie, men suck. I mean, I say that as a guy. Men can really absolutely suck.
The detail that I really like about how she responds to all these suitors is like she basically tells them, "Oh, you're comparing me to all these, extravagant treasures. If that's what you think of me, go get your treasures."
They didn't see her as a person. They saw her as an
As an
item.
object.
Yeah. And that's how the rest of the world, like, and the people saw her, because it was just like, look at this beautiful young woman. Who can we give her to strengthen our bond with that lord or whatever? It was very amusing how they did what she asked, but they didn't do it because of, oh, I actually love her. Like, they cheated their way into bringing back the magical items that she asked for. Like, Kuramochi did that whole thing of like the beautiful gem covered tree. And then the artists come back and are like, what the hell? You haven't paid us. And now your wife is looking for you. Like, a lot of these guys were like cheating on their wives. It's so ghoulish to see. Or, they would hurt themselves. Like, middle counselor Isono Kami, who's voiced by John Cho, broke his back. Kuramochi, by the way, is voiced by Beau Bridges. And then we also have like the Lord Minister of Right, Abe, voiced by Oliver Platt, who's like, I got you this beautiful fabric. It won't catch fire. And then, of course, Kaguya proves him wrong, and the fabric catches on fire, and he's, instead of being like, Oh, okay. He's like, his mood changes when he realizes that she is not impressed by his gifts, because he was like, do you know how much money that cost me? All these suitors were very much prototypical, quote unquote, nice guys.
Yep, and all of their masks start to fall off when Kaguya actually puts them to the test.
And like, you think that, like, oh, Prince Ishii Tsukuri, who's voiced by James Marsden, is going to be the one. He was trying to get away from his wife. Like, or the great counselor Otomo, voiced by Daniel Dae Kim, basically stuck at sea fighting some metaphorical dragon, that it's just not going to happen. He's stuck out there. Or you have the insanely creepy Kato, voiced by Dean Cain. I don't know how the heck he got into this voice cast, who is just like, women love me. I think she'll just love me just as much, and she'll be part of the council. And she's just like, yeah, no. And he's just like, how dare you, women? How dare you neglect my charms? And it's just like, you're not charming, dude. You're creepy. The voice cast in this one is really good. Like, probably one of the better Ghibli voice casts, where we have Chloe Grace Moretz, James Caan, Mary Steenburgen, Darren Criss, Lucy Liu, Haydn Walsh, George Segal, James Marsden, Beau Bridges, Daniel Dae Kim, Oliver Platt, John Cho, Dean Cain, and then Liam O'Brien and Caitlin Leone voice side characters, or Kaguya when she was young. But it, like, that name though, Kaguya, that's not even her name. They didn't even give her a name. It
Yeah,
was chosen.
she's just princess.
It was Inbei no Akita, who I think looks a little more caricature than the others, though I think it works out for who they are as these characters. It's just like, I think we should just name her Kaguya, and I say so. And then the bamboo cutter and his wife are like, oh, well, okay then, that's her name. And they lose track of, like, they're not greedy parents. They're just ignorant to reading the room with Kaguya of what she wants. And even though, as of this point in time, she is not happy, you find out that she is from the moon. And now that she was like, I want to get out of here because of this stupid suitor situation. But then she's realizing, if I go back there, I'm not going to find the joys of this world that has brought to me, even like the ups and downs and all around pros and cons of this world. It makes me happy because I feel alive. I'm not just stuck in one place. It's a very mature movie, despite the sometimes cartoonish expressions and art style. You feel so bad for the character because it's not really a happy ending either for Kaguya.
It's a very bittersweet ending because, even though she gets like that final moment to say goodbye to her parents, when she puts on that robe, like that's it. Her memory, all of the fun times that she had on Earth, all of that is wiped away.
And it's sad. And this movie captures the feeling of tragedy and emotions, like pure unfiltered emotions, through this movie beautifully. Like, a lot of people pinpoint the scene where she's running through doors and dropping all the robes and beautiful clothes that she has because of how people see her. It's like, it's so beautiful where the art style gets a little rough looking on purpose. Like, this movie, it's just so gorgeous to look at. It's another one of those every frame's a painting kind of movies. And the fact that, like, they don't fill in everything, they make you feel these are memories that we are looking at.
There's a quote that I found on Wikipedia where Takahata was describing he wanted people to imagine or recall the reality deep within the drawings rather than be distracted by a realistic art style.
And I think
And
that works. Like, why? The best part about animation is you are not stuck with realism. You don't have to worry about the realistic aspects of live action filmmaking, which is why a lot of the paintings and backgrounds or environments have like very empty areas, but it pulls you into its world more. The tone and vibe of that scene or location that they are in. You even get a little more of that tragedy and like more folktale like logic when you think Kaguya is leaving to the countryside back to her original village and meets back up with Sutemaru, voiced by Darren Criss, and that it's like, let's go away, let's live together, and they fly through the air, which is probably the best scene of the movie, next to Kaguya dancing under the cherry blossoms. But then you realize it was a dream from Sutemaru, just of what could have been. This movie is very good at kind of like this year's Robot Dreams of sending you up and then just like ripping out your heart at the end.
Yeah, I definitely felt that way, which is why I had such a hard time coming up with my Letterboxd review, because I was just kind of sitting there, just letting the movie just sit with me, because there's just a lot of emotion this movie expresses. In the first half, it kind of lures you into a false sense of security with Kaguya's more carefree lifestyle, hanging out with Sudamaru and his friends. But then the second half, things get a little bit more somber, and Kaguya's responsibilities become a bit more heavy. Like we mentioned, the ending is not a happy one. It's very bittersweet, but the movie as a whole is just very cathartic.
Yeah, so it's like Kaguya realizes that she is going to be returning to the moon and there is nothing that she can do. So she does what she can to spend the time with her parents and vice versa with the bamboo cutter and such to be there for her when she leaves. They try to prevent her from being taken back, but they're obviously overpowered because Buddha is just like, nah. Humans will not be able to stop us. But there's that little moment that I like where the Buddha, before putting the robe back on her, is like willing to let her have one last moment.
That was nice.
And it's all told through visual storytelling, like no lines or anything like that. So he just lets her be, but then at that moment, after she hugs them both and tells him like how much she wants to stay and such, the robe goes on. And she is taken back. And you see the robe kind of worked, but she is crying at the end because of just what is now gone from her. It's not a happy ending, but it is a good ending. I feel like a lot of animation fans who think they are like aware and familiar of the different types of endings to movies really only like purely happy endings. Nothing against them, but I remember when I saw reviews for this film and from YouTubers and such, they're like, oh, wow, that ending was dark. What the hell? That, ugh. And it's just like, that's kind of what happens in the story, buddy. This ain't a Disney movie. man. But yeah, I'm interesting. We went from My Neighbor the Yamadas. And then end with the tale of the Princess Kaguya. And what was your impression overall as we wrap this all up before we talk about the boy and the heron in the next episode?
Overall, I just think in general, this has been probably one of the best experiences going through, I want to say, what, 40 plus years of some of the best animated films, or just films in general, from like top shelf talent, from like the directors, writers, everyone involved in like the production, the art directors, the animators, of course, all three of the movies that we discussed in this episode, and majority of Miyazaki's work composed by the ever amazing Joe Hisaishi. There's just so much talent across all of these 23 and soon 24 films from the Ghibli library, and just kind of reaffirmed everything that I love about animation.
There's a reason why Studio Ghibli in their movies are like the one thing non-anime fans will watch, because they are not bogged down by traditional anime tropes and techniques. Just because it's animated and it's from Japan, because, you know, anime is just another word for animation, so we'll talk about that conundrum another time. They told stories that were the forefront of every film that they made. And they're so timeless with their themes and their characters. And sure, as the studio went on, they didn't all have hits. Ocean Waves, Tales from Earthsea, and Earwig and the Witch are still probably their weakest movies.
Oh, yeah.
And sadly, whether intentional or not, the studio did a very bad job of making sure to keep fresh talent on board or to cultivate it, because for some reason they were very stingy about it. Like, they could go out right now and get some of the directors of some of the best anime out there right now, like Ayumu Watanabe or the director behind Frieren, or like some others, Mario Kata or Naoko Yamada, to make movies for them. There are amazing people out there who have incredible stories and directing skills, but they're like, after Takahata passed away, it was very much like, we only need Miyazaki. And it's just like, no, bring in some other talent and talk with them about, hey, what is a kind of movie you want to make? Because otherwise, what is going to happen with Studio Ghibli after Miyazaki passes? He's apparently interested in making another movie, but that's probably going to take 5 to 6 years. And who knows if he'll still be around by that time. Like, is it just going to be a arm of the bigger company that recently bought it out? Or I like that they didn't just pick willy-nilly to make whatever films. They care about their output, but it's sad that there might be a time where Studio Ghibli is no more, and yet their art will live forever.
I really don't want to think about the possibility of losing Studio Ghibli simply because both Takahata and eventually Miyazaki will no longer be with us.
Like, I don't want them to make films just for the sake of it. I want them to keep what makes them special and not just be like a journeyman studio of just like, hey, we'll do whatever.
Right. Now, that might be part of the reason why, as frustrating as it can be from the outside looking in, that Studio Ghibli doesn't seem to be future-proofing themselves. However, as you pointed out, it's not like Japan is running out of talent. They just need to cultivate an environment to give them a platform to create movies as memorable as Spirited Away or Castle in the Sky, Grave of the Fireflies, etc., etc. Right.
And you can see how much of the industry has been inspired by their works. There are a ton of movies that take notes of, hey, this is why their films work, let's do that, but still in their own distinct identities as filmmakers and projects. I can't imagine a world where Studio Ghibli never happened. Like, it's kind of scary. But let's end this on a more positive note. Mike, What would you say are your five favorite Studio Ghibli movies?
So my five favorite would be Princess Mononoke, Kiki's Delivery Service, Porco Rosso, The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, and Castle in the Sky.
I think mine would be Porco Rosso, Castle in the Sky, Spirited Away, Only Yesterday, and I think it might have to be Whisper at the Heart.
Good choices.
Yeah. I mean, you can't really go wrong with a lot of their films. They're just so good at their craft. And can't wait to when we can finally talk about The Boy and the Heron. I've seen it. I love it. It's my favorite movie of the year, but we're going to have to talk about that next time.
And until then, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter or Blue Sky at Cam's Eye View. I have my own website called camseyeview.biz where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/camseyeview. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me on various social media at Captain K42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and that place at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser, subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/RenegadePopCulture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at renegadepopculture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.